One. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your hosts, Luke Kim and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take calls, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome back to the Authority Smashing Hour, your favorite show with hosts Buddha Jam and Mr. 1001 Nights. How's everything going, Buddha Jam?
How's it going? It's going good. How are you, brother?
Oh, a little tired. Didn't sleep too well last night, but been...
Would you have a film opening?
Yeah, sort of. The first draft of my documentary was posted, so I'm getting a lot of feedback. And
that's great.
Should be interesting, man. Should be interesting.
Yeah, I hope we'll have to throw a link into the chat room for people to check it out.
Yeah.
Try to get that. That's awesome. And so, what is the? Well, could you tell everyone a little bit about the documentary? I mean, I'd like to just dive into this if you don't mind.
Well, I'm sure you know a little bit about it because you helped me conduct the interview with Mr. Ferguson, right?
Well, sure, but I mean, I like to, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a documentary. It all started when I heard Noam Chomsky talking about something called the investment theory of politics. He mentioned it a few times. And then I looked into it, and I realized that, you know, there weren't any documentaries about it, and I thought it would be an interesting... theme to do a documentary on. And so yeah. I thought, well, let me buy the book, see what the book's about, and see if it would be a documentary worthy theme. And I thought it was, so I arranged for an interview with Ferguson. I went to Boston, and thanks to you and our fellow host Chomsky, we were able to conduct the interview, and everything happened from there. Kept adding new things here and there, and so the first draft is done.
And just to remind our listeners, what exactly is the investment theory of politics?
Well, the investment theory has to do with the relationship between our political structures, like, you know, government and parties, and the economic structure, like corporations, investment firms, et cetera, and how, you know, we're often led to believe, if you go to school, you take a regular politics course, that there's hardly any connection, that economics and politics are two different things. But in fact,
exactly. Yeah.
What this documentary shows, and what should be obvious, is that in fact, the economics, the people who control the economy, also control the political system. The political system is an extension of that power, and basically, what the documentary shows is that the government manages the collective interest of the capitalists, particularly the rich capitalists, and that there's different blocks of investors, different blocks of capitalists who have different interests because of their nature of their industry. They may be more leading toward free market, or more protectionist, or more capital intensive, or labor intensive, meaning they employ fewer workers or have more technology replacing those workers, etc. And or they may be more finance, more of a financial institution rather than any of these other industries. So depending on where they find themselves, in the spectrum, they usually tend to fall into one party or the other. And it is the job of the government to manage those interests, and the party which has the most financial backing usually wins. So that's sort of the overall story.
Yeah. I like what Ferguson said in regards to the labor parties, like in particular he mentioned Europe, but the fact that the idea, at least, that if labor got organized enough, the business party would have to retreat. They would have to retreat into one party, right? They would form an alliance.
Right, which is true. I mean, but I mean, I think that there's a little point of sort of there, you know, we don't exactly agree 100%. I mean, I totally agree that, yeah, if Labour gets strong enough and gets to influence a party, any given party, too much, business will stop being part of that party at all and will migrate to some other party. But the, I guess that what I asked Ferguson at the time was if he didn't think that even labor parties, even the most radical labor parties, if they have, because of their very structure, as you know, sort of a hierarchical party structure, if they have the ability to allow the workers to dissolve the state ultimately, and you know, because I mean, there's no doubt parties have democratic potential. They have more democratic potential than, say, a corporation, which is a totally undemocratic structure. On the other hand, there are some problems that ultimately, you know, will have to be worked out as far as the hierarchical nature of the party itself.
Well, yeah, and I mean, that's something I've pointed out in my little series on democracy. What I love about your film, quite honestly, is it's really essentially a film about democracy, you know, and it goes into the ways that it's been contorted and twisted, and you know, but that's ultimately what we're aiming at. And you show these, you know, examples in like Bolivia and I think Venezuela.
I have to say that the best blurb I've gotten, the best compliment for the film was on on the website Freedom Main Radio, the free market crazies.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
There was a guy that said that it was thought provoking and frustrating, and I thought that's the best blurb I've gotten so far.
Wow, that's from one of those guys, huh?
Yeah, they didn't like it. I mean, they thought it was okay, but they didn't like the fact that he challenged, you know, their ideology. But anyway,
that's funny because I thought they were as anti-government as you could be. So I would thought they would have loved it, you know.
Well,
no sense.
I think they liked some parts of it, but they didn't like the fact that it was coming out in favor of democracy, and that it favored democratic involvement in government, and that it says that government can actually have some democratic potential as compared to, say, corporations. But anyway, well, right. That was that, and we'll see how that goes. And I see that you're also we have some other YouTube news. I wasn't really aware of this, but apparently the user by the name of Napalm Tube has had a sort of 180 degree change in his political thinking. Do you know anything about that, Buddha Jim?
Yeah, it's you I guess haven't watched the videos. He put out a 3-part series of videos, and basically describing what he went through. Apparently, he became suicidal at one point. He couldn't think of a reason to live, he said. You know, apparently this has been ongoing. He marked back to January of this year, maybe even further. He kind of hinted at. So it's been an ongoing thing with him. And he kind of just lets it all out there, where he was, what he went through, and where he's at now. And he's a full-blown Roman Catholic now. So it was weird to watch the video. I really wish you... it's 30 minutes. It's a lot of video to watch. But it's very interesting just to, one, like, see the arguments that he makes. And he basically, he had reduced atheism and anarchism to a sort of nihilism. Not even, I mean, you can tell he doesn't really understand what nihilism is, but, you know, to that popular idea of nihilism just being a belief in nothing, you know, that popular conception, which isn't really correct, but that's what he had basically boiled it all down to, and it just left him no reason to live. Very, very interesting video. There's been a ton of video responses, too. Did you just find out about this?
Well, I heard about it a few days ago, but I didn't get a chance to actually watch the videos. To what extent do you think that this has to do with the fact that it's hard being a radical, that it's hard Because I mean, if I remember well, Napalm too was very passionate about what almost too passionate in his videos. Like he was saying, well, you know, let's stop looking at this. Let's devote all our energies to smashing the state. And he'd say, you know, he would make these statements that were very sort of, I don't know, maybe a little immature, a little bit, but it's sort of like an all or nothing approach he sort of had. And Michael Albert, I remember when he said that all or nothing approach is not the best to have, because if you don't get it right away, or then you sort of get discouraged, and then you start. And I told Chomsky that when people, you know, come out of being a radical, they always, just by coincidence, always drift toward the status quo, the side that has the power, and where, you know, most people are, right?
Right. You know, I don't know if it was that so much. I think you kind of touched on it when you mentioned his passion. The passion was a little extreme, and I think it really bespoke a level of insecurity. You know, it's like the person who jumps up and, you know, jumps up and down and tells you that the sun is going to rise tomorrow, you know, maybe isn't quite sure of it, you know. And I think that's what we saw with Napalm too. With the passion there, what I always saw missing was any substantive understanding of the concepts he was discussing. You know, the passion was there, but it was often very superficial. In his videos that he did, in fact, if you look at his, you know, his understanding of atheism, which the guys in the chat room are saying that's mostly what he was talking about. But if you look at that, what he was basically saying is that there was questions that couldn't be answered, you know, which is, you know, like the creationist thing or any of these people, you know, there's questions that science can't answer. You know, usually the examples they bring up aren't actually valid examples, but it's true. Science doesn't have all the answers, right? And it's so funny, especially in this day and age, to watch someone who is utilizing all the fruits of our science, of our human knowledge, right? That's what technology is. It's the fruits of our human knowledge. To use all this wonderful stuff that we've developed and be like, you know, I just can't trust human wisdom or human thought. It's just, it's amazing, really.
It's like it's like a
the
fish.
Internet, the computer.
Yeah, like a fish saying, I don't trust the water, right? And but you're swimming
in it. Yeah, it's just, it's... Yeah, he went into this thing about not being able to trust his senses and all, and it's like, wow, you know, I mean, you look all around you, and hey, we haven't figured it all out by any stretch of the imagination, but humans know some stuff, you know. we're a pretty intelligent species, and we could be doing a lot more with it. I mean, that's part of the reason we do the show. That, you know, we could be utilizing this creative, intelligent energy in better ways, but you know, the evidence is all around us. But that's what I really think is that, you know, at heart, just a, like an insecurity, and then you get confronted with all these questions. It's like, I don't know how to answer them. I'll just go back to, you know, God did it. It's very easy, you know, God did it. Yeah.
Right.
And so that anything, it takes no thought.
It's tough going against the mainstream as well, because you have, you know, like Chomsky has pointed out, there's more demands on you. You can't make the same mistakes. You can't get away with the same sort of sloppy repetition you know, facts that are already in people's consciousness and stuff. So it's not easy. One interesting fact that I just thought about is that I know that last week you mentioned this thing about anarchist people of color. And
right.
Yeah, and I read the article that apparently was the offending piece, and some people actually have suggested that this was cops that actually wrote this, that it was the police, that it wasn't an actual person from that organization, that it could be a divide and conquer tactic from the police, you know. I don't know.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that's what.
But the event actually happened, right? Because a lot of people responded to the event.
Right.
So you're saying that it was a Asian provocateur that kind of led this action.
Well, that's I have no evidence. I just heard someone. Heard actually John Zierzan, the primitivist. He said that that's what it was. I mean, because they were calling Food Not Bombs a white supremacist organization, which is a little laughable. I mean, you know, if you want to find, you know, white supremacists, I know exactly the way you can find them, some real ones. But, you know, Food Not Bombs is, it wouldn't be one of those. But anyway. But, you know, I just thought that maybe it's true. I mean, maybe it's not true, but I just thought it would be worth to at least have in mind that that could be the case. We shouldn't underestimate, you know, the, no, I mean, it's sort of like it, it's all these ways to divide us, right? But also, you know, we may treat it that way too, because, you know, there's this tendency that we already have. I mean, the main problem that we have in the like on the left and anarchist or, you know, whatever, is sectarianism. And so the more divided we are, the harder things become. So,
see, that's the problem with people like you. You believe in sectarianism, so I can't deal with you anymore. So I'm going to start my own sect. It's going to be the people who don't believe in sectarianism at all sect. How would that work?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a vicious circle. I mean, it sort of it replicates itself, but you know, we just have to keep going forward and try to not, you know, not get stuck in these little altercations. I mean, it's not, we shouldn't ignore them, but you know, just be a little careful, I guess. No.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, and you should. I've seen these types of people. If this was a, you know, agent provocateur, I mean, I don't know that I've actually seen an agent provocateur, you know, officially, but I've seen people like this that come in and they just kind of stir shit up, and you always have to be wary of those people, you know, that are always looking to start, you know, static amongst people. You know, we agree on so many things. It's just, it's so ridiculous what causes, you know, sectarian stuff. You know, especially with this, where it's like, you know, anarchists of color, not APOC in particular members per se, but you know, people of color, anarchists, people of color, just really driving a wedge between their white comrades. You know, and it wasn't just whites actually at the meeting that they confronted. I mean, there were people of color there already. They left them alone, you know, from the, according to the article I read. But still, you know, like, why would you do that?
Yeah.
So, but I have some good news in the labor movement. Have you heard anything about the Carpenters Union lately?
I haven't been to, no, what's going on?
They caught a bunch of our top scumbags who were involved in this scheme. It was a $10.5 million scheme. Apparently it was headed by a local union bigwig named Michael Ford, and it was called Illicit Cash Payments, or Turkey, as it was being delivered. And they had this whole thing where, so far, Ford, Mike Ford, he's a complete scumbag, and eight carpenters, union officials, and a contractor's representative were accused by the feds of pocketing a total of $1 million in bribes. They had all kinds of stuff going on. And these are, like, pretty major figures in my union. But it's great to see them, you know, go down like this, because they were, the scheme involved alerting the contractors to job site inspections by an independent investigator assigned to monitor the union. You know, I mean, they were, let's see, what else was there? They had this thing where Ford and others took cash and gifts, including Super Bowl tickets, to let contractors hire illegal aliens, pay union workers off the books, and avoid making millions in payments to pension and other benefit funds.
Wow.
Think about that.
Wow.
Think about that right there.
That's
Super
just
Bowl tickets. This motherfucker got Super Bowl tickets, and he said, yeah, sure, hire an illegal alien, pay people off the books, and don't pay into these guys' pension fund and payments to their benefit funds. You know, that's my medical benefits right there. That's my long-term retirement, you know? I mean,
sounds like,
wow.
That guy, sounds like that guy could be a good capitalist, huh?
He is. He's a very good capitalist. And he's a scumbag. I've met the guy numerous times, and, you know, every time I've ever met him, you could tell he was high as hell on coke. And, I mean, this guy, oh, these people. It's just sick, you know. And when we look at something like this, the problem is, of course, democracy. Democracy would fix that. Because as you become, you know, as the people become more involved in the decision-making and take more and more power from assholes like this, pretty soon you don't have anybody to bribe. Once we're all equal, you know, in the decision-making process, what does it make sense to give, say, me Super Bowl tickets? Because I'm just one of 500,000 carpenters that are all equal.
Right.
They all have a say in what the union does.
We keep those tendencies in check. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole point of democracy, that all those tendencies are kept, you know, they're regulated by you know,
they're naturally regulated.
Right, right. They're naturally regulated
by the
people.
That's the beauty.
The
it's not
themselves.
Some external, it's not some, you know, brown shirts coming and bopping in the head, or like we have to have here, where we have to have the police, the state, comes in and, you know, gets these guys.
And that's precisely,
you know,
that's what I feel that the opponents of democracy always try to conflate the this self-regulating tendency of democracy and anarchism with a sort of external authoritarian force, and that's the opposite.
Oh yeah, they always do that. Yeah,
and you know, the so-called tyranny of the majority, and you know, actually, I ended up explaining that at the end of the documentary. I mean,
oh, I love that. Yeah, I love that part.
Oh, you actually watched that? You know, I have to say that a lot. You know, most of that stuff on democracy, I got from your videos, man. I mean, I did. Yeah, but anyway, I mean, that's something that's always confused.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's funny because when I was watching that last little part there about, you know, the herd mentality, and I've seen those old 46 films you got the stuff from.
Yeah.
They're on the archive.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a pretty cool little deal they do on democracy between despotism and liberty. You know, the economic equitability, how much we share power, all those, you know, respect. That was an interesting thing that they used, right?
Yeah.
The more that you respect your fellow citizens.
It was very straightforward. I mean, that's what I liked, that he was like, it was no bullshit. It was like, they had a simple chart, you know, a power on the top.
Yeah.
And then, and I thought, wow, you know, this is, I can really use this, you know?
It was great. And I love how you went into the herd mentality actually being, you know, something that happens when there's no democracy, you know, when there's a lack of democracy. That's when we've seen it happen again and again. It certainly plays out through history. I mean, Germany was not a democratic system, and I've been thinking a lot about that. Like that meant, you know, that 10-year period where they went from, you know, the pinnacle of civilization to barbarism, you know, those people, no matter where you were at in that ladder, you know, whether you were a brown shirt or on the other end, everybody was terrifying, you know? I mean, you hear that again and again if you read the history of people just being afraid and just doing what they were told, you know, not trying to step out of line, not trying to draw too much attention to themselves. Everybody in that society was scared to death, you know, and it was that herd mentality really works in that kind of an environment.
Well, it's funny you say that because, you know, you sent me that article about you know, more and more women, they get their genitalia operated on to achieve a certain look or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking, you know, our society has so many insecurities, and they're fostered by the culture that we live, the materialistic culture that we live in, because. You know, if everyone's afraid, I mean, it's an old story. You know, you consume and you're easier to control. And there's so many things you can say about that insecurity, how it's just part of our culture.
Well, the entire advertising industry, and that's billions upon billions and billions and billions of dollars, is all aimed at making us feel insecure. Every single ad you see. You know, your teeth aren't wide enough, your hair's not long enough, your butt's too big, it's too small, it's, you know, your skin's not dark enough.
And I thought it was sort of tragic comic. I mean, imagine that, you know, I'm a guy and I have, you know, the penis enlargement surgery, and you're a woman and you have the vagina whatever surgery, and we get together and it's like, well, couldn't have we just avoided all this and just, you know, I mean... And it's sort of it's a race, you know. Okay, and now I have this surgery. It's not good enough. Now I need to have it because I need to have some other part of my body because now I'm not good enough for that. And they'll come up with some other surgery. Now you can get really beautiful this and that. I mean, you know, there's no end to it, right? I mean,
right. Well, I joked around today on Twitter. I said, whatever happened to bumping uglies? You know, I mean, we're all gonna get our genitalia sculpted at the plastic surgeon. It's just unbelievable. And, you know, but in a serious note, it's something to bring up, I think, for anybody. You know, we get into these arguments about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. People always want to, you know, paint these people as barbarians, you know, and they'll bring up something like genital mutilation that happens in some Muslim countries. I don't even know if it happens in Iraq. But genital mutilation is a big thing with these, you know, people on the right use it all the time. And so something to bring up is this really an epidemic we have of genital, it's mutilation, really. They call it plastic surgery, but it's genital mutilation that people, you know, go into debt to have. And, you know, and it's, yes, it's voluntary. It's not on the same level as genital mutilation, but... it's that voluntary within a capitalist society, you know, which is never really voluntary.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the point that one of these free marketeers would say, hey, but they're voluntarily doing this because they always ignore what we point out about collective consciousness. Why do you have all these insecurities? Why do you have all these? Do we really believe that we are not subject to the pressures of the collective consciousness that has been created by years of propaganda, by years of advertising, by TV, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, we are part of that. Now, if you want to ignore all that and say, hey, it's a voluntary choice, no, it's a more subtle form of coercion, and it's there, and that leads, you know, Chomsky has said that it's sort of a self-imposed totalitarianism, because you have this pressure from the outside, and then you do to yourself what the Taliban would have done to you, you know? Well, maybe not exactly the same thing, but I'm saying that you have all these things that are going on that amount to sort of some of the same results.
John, we have a question from Captain Franick, and he says, I keep hearing people saying that current Somalia proves that anarchism is unworkable. Do you have a comment?
Well,
Somalia proves
if you type the word strawman on your browser, I'm sure you'll find the exact definition of that. Well, I mean, you know, this is actually interesting because a lot of people associate anarchy with a chaos and basically groups, small little states fighting each other for power, which is basically what Somalia has been. If I understand it well, there's small armed factions, hierarchical, yeah, of course, factions who are fighting for power. And there's no... Remember that the definition of the state is sort of a centralized structure with a monopoly over the legitimate use of force, right? Isn't that the definition by Bart Weber? So when you have these sort of things going on over there, you don't have one government with that monopoly. You have small groups fighting for it, and it's not like one group is fighting for liberate. No, I mean, these are all hierarchical groups fighting for power, fighting for elite power. And they're like mini states, they're small states. And that's very different from a movement that tries to organize itself on non-hierarchical sort of grounds. You know, that's what we're going after. So it's just another strawman. You know, it's just So what do you think about that, Buddha Jim?
Well, I'm just actually checking out. There's an article here on that someone put in the chat room, and it's the argument. It says since 1991. Somalia is cited as a real-world example of a stateless society and legal system. So that's how it starts, and it goes into telling you about it. So that's the argument they're trying to give, I guess, because it's in a, like you said, in a constant state of chaos, that, you know, it's a stateless society.
Well, I mean, the gulags were socialism, right? Isn't that what socialism is about? When you're actually murdered and tortured in a concentration camp, isn't that what socialism is? Right? I mean, that's
well, not- yeah. I don't know if they're making that strong of a statement though, in saying that it's a real world example of a stateless society. I mean, for instance, like if we go to Max Weber's definition, it's, you know, an entity that has a legitimate use of force, right? A monopoly on legitimate use of force. None of these warlords really has the legitimate use of force. That's what they're fighting over, to legitimize themselves, right?
Right.
If you take over all the warlords and you become the master warlord, and now you have the legitimate use of force and violence. Now you can control the area.
Right.
So
I mean,
in a sense, yeah, I'm just wondering, would you agree that at least in a sense it is a stateless society? Doesn't mean it's the stateless society that we envision, and doesn't mean that the reason it's in the state it is just you know, some natural law. I mean, you know.
Well, I said that maybe more accurate is to call them mini states, because they do have these groups have power over their turf. It's like and you wouldn't call the mafia, for example, a state, but they do have power. Over at least more power than most other people over a certain territorial area. So if I'm a mafia don, you know, I'm still not a state, because the government can come into my neighborhood with police cars, and in fact, mafia dons live usually within the confines of a state. But in this particular case, where there is no state, no overarching state. You have these small little states created by these competing factions fighting for power. But my point about socialism is that you've had...
Oh, I know.
You basically demonize certain terms in order to say, well, the only alternative to this chaos and this horrible stuff is capitalism. You know, just, you know, that's the only alternative, you know.
Right. There is no alternative, right?
Right. I mean,
that's Thatcher's old phrase.
If you don't choose Wall Street, you'll end up in the gulag, or you'll end up in Somalia somewhere, being shot in the middle of all this quote unquote anarchy, et cetera, et cetera. So you gotta give us the money for the bailout. It's for your own good. It's for your own good.
Well, yeah, I believe the anarchy in Somalia is actually one of the main examples given in the anarchist FAQ at InfoShop. There's the Spanish Revolution, then anarchy in Somalia.
Right.
You know, so, no, yeah, it's interesting that, you know, again, that feeds into that, you know, Tina phrase, there is no alternative, because this is what a stateless society would look like. Chomsky had a pretty funny little thing he said, that maybe it represents more or less an ANCAP society, an anarcho-capitalist society, you know, what that would, you know, fall into.
Well, I actually think it would, because, I mean, the people who espouse that ideology, they always say, well, it'll be, you know, nice people trading with each other, I give you apples, you give me bananas, but it turns out that you end up getting... they're not against inequalities, and in my opinion, that type of society leads to competition and to inequalities. So soon enough, you'll have people have to protect their property. They'll hire private security firms, quote, you know, like Blackwater and stuff like that, and you'll end up getting maybe not what you get in Somalia. Maybe it'll be you'll have a higher level. Yeah, maybe worse, but you'll have all these different
factions.
Maybe
Somalia start looking good.
Yeah, maybe you ought to move down there after the anarcho-capitalist revolution comes, huh?
Right. You know, I have one thing, though, I have to take issue with you, Mr. 1001 Nights, and I don't know if you know this, but the anarcho-capitalists that on YouTube have industrialized. There's less and less of the fruit trading going on. The last anarcho-capitalist I dealt with, he gave an example of his boomerang factory. So that's what he was trading, boomerangs from his boomerang factory. And I thought, you know what? That's pretty cool. These guys are like, industrialized. You know, at least in their minds, the little arguments they make, they're like becoming industrialized, you know? So now they're trading. I think another guy gave an example. He had a shoe factory. And it's so funny. They make up these little factories, you know, in their mind, their little arguments. And then they're like, are you going to take away my boomerang factory, Buddha Jim? Like, no, you can have your boomerang factory. I promise. We won't take it during the revolution, you know. But they are industrializing. So I think that might lead them astray from anarcho-capitalism. They keep going that route. So
yeah,
let's cross our fingers.
I wonder if Hitler gave a banana to Stalin, would that be free trade?
Yes.
It would.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
But once Stalin like had it in his possession, then it would be like complete tyranny.
Oh, but while it was being traded, that would be free trade.
While it was like in the trading process, you know.
Okay.
Because you're only responsible for what you do, right? Like in anarcho-capitalist, like if I sell you nuclear bombs and you go murder like a whole continent of people, like that's not my fault.
Right.
Yeah. You know. I mean, that's how they believe. You know, like you know, as a seller, you have no like moral. There's no moral argument. You know. Like, sell whatever you can, make a buck, right?
Because
that's the society we live in.
Because selling itself is the highest achievement of morality, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's God. How can you, you know, the market, it's God. The market is moral.
Well, yeah, and just to give a sign of the craziness of capitalism, I don't know if you guys have heard about the Cash for Clunkers program. I know the right wing, a lot of people have been very critical of it for all kinds of reasons. But it's an amazing look at capitalism because here we have this program. I think I told you a little bit about it earlier, Jonathan, where the government will give you anywhere from $3,500 to $4,500 rebate against a new car. You have to trade in your old car, and there's some rules. I think it can't be older than 25 years old. The new car has to get better gas mileage than the old one. And then the government, but the key is when you trade that car in, the dealer has to have that car destroyed. And if you watch any of the news broadcasts, and I actually work with a couple of guys that have done this. The cars that these people are trading in are perfectly nice cars. And the deal is that they all these really nice cars that a lot of Americans don't even have or can't even afford, the ones that are being traded in, are going to be destroyed. That's how capitalism works. There's plenty of cars probably in this country for everybody, but that doesn't get the capitalism gears flowing. You have to destroy perfectly good stuff, right? I mean, it's nuts, and we're doing that with houses. We have over 18 million empty houses and only 3 million homeless people, right? In a civilized society, that'd be a no-brainer. We'd be like, wow, we've got more than enough houses for everybody. You know, we could put every single person in their own house and still have 15 million vacant houses. It's a no-brainer, right? We've already paid for them as taxpayers with all these bailouts. But, no, you know, you tell someone that and they go, no, you can't do that. That's just crazy. Just because we have all the houses doesn't mean these people can live in them.
That's something, you know, like in my neighborhood, there's so many, like, there's this this Chinese restaurant which has been closed for, you know, 10 years. And it's a huge space. And it's been closed.
Yeah,
and I thought I could have moved in and save rent. I could, you know, and
right.
And then you have all these buildings. Like you have a supermarket here. It's one of the few 24-hour supermarkets in the city, but it's right by where I live. And they're closing it down. It's called Cala Foods. And they're building some, you know, some mall or something. But I figured, you know, why? And I think they're tearing down a certain part of the building to expand something useless. And you start thinking about this, and it's like, you know, why are you destroying something that so much effort went into making that building, and now you're destroying it for no real good reason other than that you want to create some sort of new business thing here that people didn't really vote for? I mean, it's just...
I get, you know, reminded of that craziness every day. I work like a stone's throw from Yankee Stadium. But you guys know the new Yankee Stadium just opened this year. They're right next to each other. There's nothing wrong with the old Yankee Stadium. I mean, I've been to plenty of games at it. It's fine. It's not like it wasn't about to fall down. It's so weird to see those two giant stadiums, and right now they're getting in the process of taking the old one apart, you know, taking it down. And it's like, wow, you know, all the work that went into building that thing, and they're going to destroy it.
So I mean, just like think you about said, this. I mean,
it's just crazy.
So when actual repairs are needed, like you know, during Katrina, the levees and all this stuff, then you don't get it. But when you don't need it, then you get it. I mean, that's the magic of capitalism.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's no joke because our nation's infrastructure is in the toilets. I mean, the Civil Union of or the Union of Civil Engineers puts out a report every year, and we're always in the C's and D's. I mean, our nation's infrastructure from, you know, electricity grids, freeways, public transit, all that stuff, the majority of it was built by my grandfather's generation. This stuff's old. It's decrepit. It's falling apart. That's why we have things like bridges collapsing. That's why we have, you know, rolling blackouts and major blackouts in certain major metropolitan areas. This stuff is, you know, falling apart, folks. And yet, you know, here we are, going to spend our energy on destroying perfectly good cars. We're going to, you know, destroying houses. That's one of the things these great economists came up with. Well, you got to start destroying these empty houses. That way you can bring the price up. So you have houses, cars, and this is the economic system we have. I don't care what you call it, but it's sick.
Yeah.
You know, it's just sick that we have to live, you know, and that's the way to get this sick economy going. Economics is just about the distribution of, you know, services and resources and products and, you know, and if you have an economic system that can't do that, it sucks. You know, let's move on to something else.
Yeah.
You know,
that's it. I mean, and I, you know, I remember that I made a video about, you know, how, you know, if capitalists can't have a system that delivers certain, results, then capitalism has to be proven to be legitimate. I mean, because people were talking about, well, you know, what about unions and stuff like that? And I said, you know, what if everyone was organized into a union? What if they chose to actually all be organized? Could capitalists actually accept that? Could they accept low profit rates? You know, could their system be functional? I mean, if it's not even functional now that they're getting all these wonderful profits that they say are so important to keep their system going, what's going to happen when they get lower profit rates because the workforce is unionized?
Well, we do see that in certain, like the Scandinavian countries, I think, in Norway, I think the union density is around the 80 percentile. Somewhere in that range, it's pretty high. And, you know, it's a capitalist system still. So I think there is a lot of flexibility, you know, from, you know, no unionization to, you know, mass mobile, you know, unionization and everything in between. I think if anything, capitalism has shown itself to be very flexible. You know, I think what the question really is, what's the breaking point, I guess, you know, because I'm sure, yeah, I don't know what 90%, 100%.
Well,
but do they, you know, do it in such a way that they can maintain control?
I think it's not only quantity but quality. I mean, like you have some of these unions that are, you know, they're not really a union looking for change, or they're sort of like they're like the glue that maybe keeps people together in some sort of fashion. But mm-hmm. I mean, if you had if the U.S. had an 80%. Membership of the IWW, I mean, or something like that. I mean, then you wouldn't see Scandinavia. Yeah, like you would see some sort of anarchist thing going on. So Scandinavia, when you say that, I don't know what the actual percentage. I mean, I'm sure it's high, but it's the kind of unions that we're talking about here. They're sort of like government sanctioned, you know, sort of. I don't know what you would call them, but you know.
They're certainly, you know, benefiting from that unionization. I mean,
that country has
you know, some amazing living standards and safety nets, and, you know, I mean, you're really going to be taken care of in a lot of ways that you'll never be taken care of, like, in this country, you know.
Absolutely, so. And in fact, they, from what I've read, they have the best results in terms of economic, you know, economic results in those countries, the northern European countries, Scandinavia,
yeah,
and stuff.
Right.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you want, we can go to a music break before we end, because we already.
Yeah, I think in honor of the scumbags who are trying to rob me of my pension fund and my medical care and that of you know, thousands and thousands of other union carpenters. To remind people what unions are really all about, with a song by Tom Morello. Check it out.
go-go. For the fight of the workers, we're twisted, tricked, and robbed. For the peasant in Guatemala, in a sweatshop, got your job. And she can't feed a family on the pennies that she makes. Meanwhile, the crime rate's rising up and down the Great Lakes. Vegetables left in the field, the signatures smell rotten, and the contracts and the deeds that push the race down to the bottom. They load the rubber bullets, they fire another round. I'm headed into the tear gas. Dig in, man, hold your ground. For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For the union men and women standing up and standing strong. Help! That's right. No queremos juntos vamos a ganar. See, y'all hit them where it hurts and bite the hand that feeds. You might get 1 to 3 or probation and a fine. Well, I know where I'm gonna be. I'm gonna be right on that front line. For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For the union men and women standing up and standing strong. Hey! Dirty scabs will cross the line while others stand aside and look. But ain't nobody never got nothing that didn't raise their voice and push. Like the steel worker in Ohio, the miner in West Virginia, the teacher in Chicago, janitor in Mississippi. From the sweatshops of L.A. to the fields of Mission Flats, there's a thundercloud exploding, and I'm free at last. Like Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. Like our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. Like the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. Like the union men and women standing up and standing strong. Like the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. Like the union men and women standing up and standing strong.
That was Tom Morello's new song. My favorite. Because, you know, regardless of what's going on with my union and the scumbags that they're going to haul off, unions are a good idea, and they are probably some of the most democratic institutions we have in our society. You know, and it's a shame that so few of us belong to one. So, you know, it's important to remember.
Yeah, well, you just mentioned this thing about Clinton, Bill Clinton going to North Korea to rescue these two journalists. And, you know, it's interesting because they're actually from San Francisco, which is where I live. And so there was a lot of there's a lot of noise about that. And what's interesting about it is, as always, is the assumptions that go with any story. And with this one is that you have this horrible dictatorship, and you have this angel Clinton that goes there and tries to, you know, rescue these poor women. And absolutely, I mean, that North Korea is a brutal dictatorship, and these women did not deserve to be arrested or anything like that.
Are you sure about that? Oh no, I was being serious. I understood that they were actually tried and convicted of some crimes there. Is that not true?
Well, I'm not sure about the details. I do know that for certain purposes, the leadership in North Korea decided to have a photo opportunity with Bill Clinton and release them under special circumstances. But I mean, what we have to understand here is here we are paying attention to this, but at the same time, there's countless prisoners and people being tortured in prisons in Iraq, in prisons in the United States, in Afghanistan. We've invaded two countries. Bill Clinton himself.
What? When did this happen?
Yeah.
Invaded two countries?
Yeah, that doesn't seem right, does it? Bill Clinton.
No.
Bill Clinton himself was a mass murderer. I mean, he not only imposed sanctions on Iraq that ended up killing over a million people, most of them children. And then his Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, said that they thought the price was worth it to kill half a million children. I mean, she actually said this on TV.
Yeah, and then I saw that.
And he was bombing Yugoslavia not to help anybody. That was a total lie, but because that country was not subordinating itself to the neoliberal reforms that they were trying to impose. And he was shipping arms to Turkey at the same time, which ended up killing tens of thousands of people. So, I mean, we have a criminal who goes to this country and is considered a savior. I mean, it's,
Right. Well, the reason I asked about the whether or not they had broken the law was, and that's another interesting part of the propaganda thing, was that the idea that they might have actually violated a law and were convicted and were serving a sentence, it wasn't even entertained, that was even possible. You know, it was just like, oh, we know they're bad, they must be angels, and, there was even the idea floated around with no evidence at all that North Koreans actually snuck across the border and seized them. Where the truth lies isn't the point so much as the idea that possibly they had broken the law wasn't even entertained. The Bill Clinton thing, and what's interesting is, supposedly they did all this, right? The evil North Koreans did this to get some bargaining chips. And as you said, like, essentially all they got out of it was a photo op with Bill Clinton. So it's like, you know, you're going to possibly, you know, have an armed confrontation with the world's superpower, and all you end up getting is a photo op with Bill Clinton. Like,
well, also,
maybe there's more to it than what we've been told.
Just think about this. If some country sent from their point of view, spies that are going to do or say nothing but bad things. Because, I mean, if you're the leadership in North Korea, as evil as you are,
very,
that,
very evil.
Yeah, very evil, right? But you know that...
Very, very.
That American journalists are going there just to find faults with your system. I mean, like, you know that. And, of course, we all know that it's a horrible system, but you know what they're there for. I mean, they're there to expose the crimes of the leadership to put a bad light. So for them, it is the equivalent of having, it takes you the Cuban Five, right? The Cuban Five who actually went to the United States to deliver information. I mean, the role was the same. I mean, the journalist went to North Korea to deliver information to the American people about how evil North Korea was. That's because we already know it's evil, right? So they were just going to reinforce that notion.
Very evil. Now
the Cuban Five went to on behalf of the Cuban state, which you may also think is bad. But they went there to actually get information from some of these
groups,
which were actually carrying out terrorist activities against Cuba. So one was delivering information for purely propagandistic purposes. The other was delivering information for a purpose that could be useful to prevent deaths, right? Now, of course, we have on both sides, contradictions, right? Because neither side is perfect nor good. But we would never think if the same thing had happened from the perspective of the Cubans, and the U.S. said, well, they violated the law by coming into the United States, that is the vision that actually prevails, that the Cubans violated the law by bringing their people into the United States, not the other way around. I mean, and the fact that like you say, it's not even considered that the North Koreans have any laws that are legitimate at all. I mean, because that's the assumption. They don't have any laws that we can't violate because they are wrong by definition.
Right.
They are wrong by definition.
Yeah.
That's it.
And we're almost running out of time here. I just wanted to quickly bring up Honduras. And again, with the legal stuff, the whole world has seen it as a coup. the U.S. State Department is still reviewing the matter. President Bush has appointed somebody to study the matter. And study the matter. This is a coup by any way you look at it. The State Department is studying the matter still. Let's just remind ourselves that they pulled him out of the country in his pajamas. They forged a letter of resignation for the president, President Zelaya of Honduras, and are refusing him reentry to the country at gunpoint. Anyone who needs assistance in figuring out that that's a coup needs to go back to school, because that is the very definition of a coup. I don't get it, you know. I do get it, but just,
Once again, the standards whether or not is being done by us or to us. So if anybody has done anything remotely similar to the President of the United States, with much less than that, we would have considered it a coup, and in fact worth going to war over. But if we do it to them, once again, it's like the North Korean example that if they had sent people here to write an article and stuff like that, you know, we would have said, you know, these evil commies are coming over here so we would have arrested them. And yeah, I mean, the double standards are everywhere you look, very, very clear.
Yeah, and let's not forget that 1 in 4 prisoners in the world resides in the United States of America. 1 in 4. That's crazy. 1 in 4 right here. You know, we talk about the gulags in North Korea, and yet we house 1 in 4 prisoners on the planet.
Yeah, and you know, maybe we ought to ask ourselves, how fun is it to be gang raped in jail? Which is how, you know, happens to a lot of people. They're gang raped. You know, is that a form of torture? In fact, they know about this. You know, I was talking to a lawyer who's been working in the city of San Francisco for, you know, over 25 years. And the guy said that the lawyers and they make jokes about it. These people know that a lot of these people get raped in jail.
And they actually, the racism within the system is institutionalized. They go out of their way to make sure. We just had a huge racial riot in California. A lot of people heard about. Dozens and dozens of people hurt. Nobody killed, thankfully. You know, property destroyed. We don't care about that. But they had to shut down like 9 other prisons. You know, and it was racially motivated. And that racial antagonism is institutionalized by the prison system itself. You know. So it's a shame, you know, and that's what we're becoming, is a police state, you know, with all, you know, millions of prisoners, everyone's scared to death, the police murdering people, on a way too regular basis and beating people on an even more, you know, more often basis. It's just, it's disgusting, you know. If this isn't the time to start making changes, I don't know when we're going to do it.
Let's not forget that the slaughter in Afghanistan keeps going. I mean, if you go to a website like antiwar.com, you can read the news. You have people getting killed by these drones all the time. And as I point out in my documentary, Obama is building these huge bases, which indicate an intention to stay for a long time.
Right. Let's see, we have about a minute remaining. Was there anything you wanted to bring up tonight that we didn't get to?
I don't
think... 1,000 more minutes?
I don't see any questions here. We have a general question about capitalism, but I guess we can always answer that in the next show. Okay. If you want, we can just break with a song or something.
Yeah, that sounds good. Let's see... I haven't uploaded anything new lately. See, did I ever play Police Origins? I'm gonna play that. It's a minute. The Origins of the Police.
The origins of the police force need to be understood. The police force in this country really began one in the South during slavery, where people, you know, y'all understand, most white folks in the South did not own anybody.
Right.
Du Bois said 7% of the white South owned 76% of the enslaved African population. Mm. So that means the majority of whites, he said like 5 million whites owned nobody, meaning that most white folks in the South were poor, peasants,
right.
You know, disenfranchised groups. So it was out of this community that the elite whites selected poor whites to patrol to catch the escaped property. which is us. So that's the first origin of the police force.
All right,
so we have to understand. And in the North, it has a similar origin. In the North, the police force begins with corporate owners paying off private security groups to police and break up unions and labor organizing. So the police in this country, North or South, have always been about protection of property and not individual rights. Right?
Cool.
That was excellent.
It's a cool little, you know, reminder. The police, it's all about property, folks. And, you know, they're out to protect their property any way they can. And they're pretty good at it. So thanks, everybody, for stopping by the show. It's Mr. 1000 Nights and Buddha Gem. And hopefully we can see you guys same bat time, same bat channel next week. And, you know, join in the struggle. We need you.
Keep up with the good work, folks. See you next
week. All right. Peace out, everybody.